I want to take a break from the podcast right now, and I want to give you a gift. And I want to do that to thank you for being a listener. I put my heart and soul into this podcast. I love interviewing today's experts, researchers, MDs, psychologists, sleep trainers, you name it. I hope you feel inspired to take care of yourselves and your families. And I just want to thank you for being a listener and hanging out with me. So the code PODCAST10 is going to give you a one-time $10 off code at kellylevesque.com, your next order of protein powder. You can either use that on my grass-fed beef isolate protein or on my new vegan chocho bean protein. Now, here's what I love about my protein powders. It's 3 ingredients or less. So we don't use fillers, emulsifiers, no fortified vitamins or minerals. It's easy to digest and naturally made without any enzymes or chemicals like hexane. So it's 3 ingredients. With my grass-fed beef isolate, that's 100% grass-fed beef, and it's made in the way that you would make bone broth. So just heat and water. And we dehydrate it, that end product, to get that collagen-rich protein powder that your whole family can drink. It can be added to coffees, to smoothies, and you can get it in vanilla, chocolate, and unflavored. I want to point out that my vanilla and chocolate is made with organic vanilla bean, organic cacao, and the only sweetener used is organic monk fruit. We don't use any maltodextrin. Our monk fruit is 100% ground monk fruit, and it's organic. And with my vegan line, I'm so excited to have launched this and to have it out into the world. It's a regenerative bean from South America called the chocho bean. And the chocho bean is the most superior plant-based protein powder you can get your hands on, because not only is it a complete protein, but the process is made with heat and water only. They're crushed and soaked, and what that end product results in is an anti-nutrient-free protein powder. So you're not gonna have any lectins, phytates, or oxalates in your protein powder. Makes it super easy to digest, and it's really, really delicious and robust in cooking as well. So I love it if I want a thicker smoothie or a smoothie bowl. And I also love it in my baked goods, from my cookies to my muffins, pancakes, and breads. It's the perfect protein addition. So if you want to give either of these proteins a try, or you've already been purchasing these proteins and want to take advantage of this special deal, the code PODCAST10 is going to get you $10 off for being a listener here at the Be Well by Kelly podcast. So head to kellylevesque.com or bewellbykelly.com. Put the protein you'd like to purchase in your cart and use the code PODCAST10 for $10 off. Thank you, thank you, thank you for tuning in. Hey, you guys, welcome back to the show. I am so excited about today's guest. Dr. James D. Nicolantonio is a cardiovascular research scientist and doctor of pharmacy at St. Luke's Mid-America Heart Institute in Kansas City, Missouri, and the author of The Salt Fix, Super Fuel, The Lungs Longevity Solution, and now The Immunity Fix. Perfect timing. A well-respected and internationally known scientist and expert on health and nutrition, he has contributed extensively to the health policy and has even testified in front of the Canadian Senate regarding the harms of added sugars. He is the author and co-author of approximately 200 publications in medical literature. Dr. D. Nicolantonio is passionate about sharing practical ways to fight chronic disease throughout lifestyle habits and health hacks. He's also a dad, a hubby, and we're just so happy to have his knowledge and expertise on today's show. Dr. James, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on. Excited to be here.
Oh, wow. I feel like since The Salt Fix, all you've done is say, hey, this is some medical advice that's out here. I'm going to debunk it for you. So first of all, thank you so much for doing that, starting with The Salt Fix, but you really have gone against so much medical advice. So I want to start from the beginning, if you don't mind. I'd like to start with Salt Fix, because a lot of people have been told that salt causes hypertension. Can you debunk that for us?
Sure. Well, I mean, when we talk about salt, usually it's just blanket statements that everyone should go on a low amount of salt. And I mean, we need to understand that salt is an essential mineral. And there's always this U-shaped curve with every single mineral. You can either get too much, too little, and then there's always a perfect or optimal amount of intake. And so, you know, the American Heart Association essentially says eat less than a half a teaspoon of salt. Whereas they really should be saying, what's the optimal intake? And to not give a lower limit of where people should at least eat a minimum amount of goes to show you that they're sort of just making blanket statements. If you look at it, anytime you restrict sodium below 3,000 milligrams per day, all your salt retaining stress hormones increase. So renin, angiotensin II, aldosterone, the things that we block with medications to prevent heart attacks and heart failure are all increased by about 3 to 10 fold when you go on a low salt diet. So why would you want to do that? Essentially, the cost of that outweighs any small benefit that you might get on a reduction of blood pressure.
It's so interesting. So other than sodium, what other minerals are you finding that people are deficient in or not having enough of to really create balance in the body?
That's the key, is that most people are lacking potassium and magnesium, and that can get you into trouble in regards to, now all of a sudden you may not be able to tolerate normal amounts of salt, because even a slight deficiency in magnesium will cause the body to retain extra salt. So you do have to eat a whole food diet that has good amounts of potassium and magnesium. But when you do that, there was a really good study that I covered in the Salt Fix. And it looked at a Japanese population that was consuming 15 grams of salt. So essentially almost twice the amount of salt that we consume in the United States per day. And all they did was they raised their potassium from 3 to 7 grams. And that took these essential high blood pressure patients back to normal blood pressure. So that goes to show you that was a clear, clinically proven case that you can consume a very high salt intake, and as long as you increase the potassium, you can have normal blood pressure.
Can you explain the mechanism of action there? You're taking me back to the sodium-potassium pump, and I need a refresher.
Sure. Well, the sodium-potassium pump is actually somewhat controlled by salt itself, but also magnesium. So it's really the magnesium and the ATP from magnesium that drives that pump. And essentially, that pump is sort of pushing sodium out of the cell and keeping potassium in the cell. And when you don't have enough magnesium, sodium and calcium start to accumulate in the cell, which can lead to vasoconstriction, calcification of the arteries, and high blood pressure. Now, so most people think that that's just due to magnesium deficiency, but there's been a lot of studies showing that if you don't get enough salt, that can actually lead to not only the bone pulling sodium to maintain normal sodium levels, but also magnesium and calcium, leading to a negative magnesium and calcium balance. So it's important that you get optimal amounts of all of these nutrients for the sodium, potassium, ATPase, or pump to work correctly.
Wow, look at that. So you're basically, for anyone listening, low sodium or low salt intake can not only potentially cause elevated heart rate, but it also can pull minerals from the bone. Are there any other chronic disease states or issues that you see with low sodium diet?
The most common is orthostatic hypotension. Essentially, if you go from like a seated to a standing position, you feel very dizzy because you have a low blood volume. So people forget that salt, we need salt to have a blood pressure, and having a blood pressure is actually a good thing. We need it to live. It's the fact that when you have a chronically elevated blood pressure, that's the problem. And that doesn't happen really with normal salt intakes. That happens when you consume chronic amounts of sugar, leading to chronic elevations in glucose and insulin. And essentially, it's really not the elevation in sodium in the blood that happens chronically and leads to volume overload. That just happens quickly. It's the glucose that's chronically elevated that also has an osmotic effect like sodium that pulls fluid into the intravascular space and causes volume expansion. So really, salt is an innocent bystander here as well.
Wow. So it's really the sugar that's driving up the blood volume and pulling salt into our blood and increasing our blood pressure.
It's really the sugar that's leading to the chronic elevation in glucose that's pulling fluid and volume into the blood space. We used to sort of blame this for salt, but sodium levels don't maintain chronic elevation when you eat a normal salt diet. There may be a quick spike, but it goes down very rapidly. And so what's really maintained at a chronically elevated rate is glucose levels. And that's what's really pulling volume and causing volume expansion.
Well, I'm a huge fan of balancing blood sugar and keeping glucose levels low. So we'll get to that. But before, I want our listeners to have a takeaway. What type of salt do you recommend, and how should people be salting their food?
So that's a good question. I think the least refined salt is the most important. And there are different pink salts that contain varying levels of iodine. So some people get good amounts of iodine. And if you start consuming a salt that has a lot of iodine in it, you might push yourself over your threshold, because iodine has this very narrow therapeutic window where, like, between about 150 to maybe 250 micrograms is optimal. And when you start going above 250, it can sort of sometimes cause thyroid issues. It just depends on the person. So if you're already getting a lot of iodine from things like dairy and pastured eggs and shellfish and things like that, maybe you want to go with a lower pink Himalayan salt that contains less iodine, like the original pink Himalayan salt contains about maybe 20 micrograms, whereas Redmond Real Salt is a much higher iodine salt. It has about 170 micrograms of iodine per 10 grams of salt. So if you're someone who is sweating out a lot of iodine and isn't getting a lot of iodine diet, maybe Redmond might be a better choice.
Love those tips. Total takeaways. So let's get back to glucose, because if anyone's following you on Instagram, which you are a very fun follow, you talk a lot about really simple tips for people to increase wellness, and we'll get to your immunity. But can we deep dive glucose and sugar intake and how that's driving chronic disease?
Sure. So it's not necessarily glucose from whole foods. That's the problem, right? And so, I mean, a lot of women, especially if they go on a too low of a carbohydrate intake, that can sometimes tank their thyroid and sex hormones. And so a lot of women that I've worked with have told me that they do much better with a decent amount of carbohydrate intake. And I do fairly well as well with maybe 150 grams of whole food carbs per day. And I may even increase that to 200 if I was performing exercise or lifting weights. So if you're someone who is lean, has muscle, exercises, I don't necessarily know if a very low carbohydrate intake is the optimal for you. So it's really the refined processed carbs that are harmful. And so that would be almost all whole grains in the United States are ran through a steel roller mill and are actually technically refined. It's almost like it may be the 1% might be stone ground and has a coarse. I just avoid all flours. That's really the tip, is to avoid any flour from grain, because it's usually typically very highly refined, will lead to a very sharp spike in glucose. And then you get the elevations in insulin, and then you're in this vicious cycle of low glucose, and then you're craving more sugar. So good carbs, bad carbs is sort of what you need to think about.
I love it. And your new book, Immunity Fix, like I said earlier in your introduction, is perfect timing. Can we go through what inspired you to write this book and some of the research that you've found in regards to increasing our immunity?
Sure. Well, it was interesting because I was actually publishing some nutraceutical strategies on what could potentially help with RNA viruses, including coronavirus. And Elsevier actually press released one of our publications. And then after a few of those came out, I said, nobody really reads the medical literature. I might as well like turn this into a book and end up being like a, you know, 2,500 reference book. But essentially, no one was talking about how people can improve their own immune health, because really how we handle viruses depends on how well our T cells and our B cells are working, and our innate immune system, which is our natural killer cells and all these things. And your own metabolic health and your own nutrient status directly determines how well your own immune system is going to respond to any type of virus. And so really, I just wanted to get that message out that your own metabolic health is very important for handling any type of virus.
That's great. So what are some of the takeaway tips that listeners can start implementing right away?
Well, I love this story because it sort of hits home. There's a different type of RNA virus called the Coxsackie virus. And in some children, it causes hand, foot, and mouth. In other people, it doesn't cause anything. But if you are selenium deficient and you get infected with this virus, it leads to something called Keyshan disease, cardiomyopathy, and can potentially kill you. So it's really the lack of selenium that can cause death from an RNA virus. We have that actually confirmed from Coxsackie. So now here we have coronavirus, which is another RNA virus. And it would be, I think, very smart of us to consider nutrient status when it comes to how well we handle this virus. So when we took a look at the literature, I sort of rank ordered which types of nutrient deficiencies have been associated with an increase in mortality from COVID-19. And the very top one was vitamin D, with If you are severely deficient in vitamin D, you're at a 15-fold high risk of dying from COVID-19, which is much higher than even if you're older. So if you're over 60, the risk for, is increased by 9-fold. And you can't fix your age, but you can certainly fix your vitamin D levels. And then when looking through the data, selenium deficiency increases the risk of dying from COVID-19 by 5-fold and zinc deficiency by 2-fold. And then in between all of that, you have metabolic syndrome increasing the risk of COVID-19 death by about 3.5-fold, and hypertension, cardiovascular disease, things that are driven by poor diet and lifestyle. So when you start taking all these risk factors into account, and then you see how many of them are actually affected by nutrition and your own health status, you can start painting a picture of how you can improve your own diet and lifestyle to sort of shield yourself, or hopefully you have a better outcome from different types of viruses.
It's all about getting that nutrient, getting out of the deficiency zone when it comes to nutrients, making sure that your body has what it needs. And I think about our immune system really like a bunch of little army guys out there fighting everything that our body comes in contact with. So let's talk about, how do we test? What should people be looking for on a blood test, or for the level of vitamin D they should have and selenium they should have? And how should they be supplementing or including it in their diet?
Sure. So most people realize that blood levels for minerals are not a good test. But what most people don't realize is that they actually can be very good if you look at a person's level and they're at the low normal end. So what happens with mineral deficiencies is you don't go subnormal unless you are extremely deficient. But what happens is the blood level slightly goes down. So if you are on the low normal end of a blood level for even magnesium, let's say, that's highly suggestive of magnesium deficiency, particularly if you get a 24-hour urinalysis and the magnesium excretion is low. And that indicates the body is trying to hold on to magnesium. Now, it's not perfect, because you may not be absorbing magnesium well. And that's why, you know, there's not a lot coming out in the urine, but it's an indication that if there's low amounts of magnesium in the urine, that your body is probably trying to hold on to the magnesium and you're deficient.
Okay. So for minerals, we're looking to be on the low end of normal, because that's indicating we're holding on to minerals, and or we're never going to drop below into a deficient zone. But that means that we probably need to supplement. So let's talk about what would be the ideal supplementation amounts for, because you include magnesium too, for magnesium, selenium, and vitamin D.
Right. So I try to hit 400 to 500 milligrams of magnesium, selenium about 300 to 400 micrograms, and vitamin D is sort of, it depends on how much sunlight you're getting. I think the goal would definitely be to be above 30 nanograms per ml on a D level. And so I don't like to give numbers, because some people can get above 30 with 1,000 IUs, and some people may need 4,000. So You'll hear, I mean, a lot of the studies do show that an optimal level for vitamin D maybe is around 55 to 60. Now, there's some nuance there, because some people convert to the active form much better. And so they can have a somewhat lower level, probably like myself, but you're so good with magnesium that you're converting it to the active form very well. Whereas some people may have a higher level and aren't converting it very well to the active form. So there's some nuance in play there, but I think somewhere between 31 and 60 is probably a good range to sort of shoot for.
Great. And we can just get that on, you can get that on a regular Quest blood test, yep, if anyone's listening.
That's nanograms per ml, because sometimes it's measured in, I think, millimoles or something like that in the UK. It's different, and it's high, those numbers are higher.
Got it. Cool. So we're working on our vitamin D status, our selenium status, and our magnesium status. And if I heard you correctly, magnesium is a cofactor in converting what our body uses to create vitamin D, the active form of vitamin D. So magnesium being so, so important. Is there a type of magnesium that you suggest people take? Because there are so many different forms.
Well, I always think we should be getting our nutrition from food. Most people like to try to just simplify things, but the body is super complex. So for a while, yes, I was thinking, well, maybe I can just get like magnesium from a supplement, or maybe I'll just get it from, I mean, even mineral waters are a great source of magnesium too, if you get natural mineral waters. But I think if you can find whole food sources, I think they're going to provide other nutrients as well. So for example, like spinach, I is a great source of magnesium, but also potassium and also bicarbonate forming substances. So a lot of people are consuming a high, let's say, animal-based diet, like myself. It's very important to offset that acid load. Otherwise, you start taxing your own bicarbonate status, and that can lead to potential issues down the road. So 6 ounces of spinach cancels the acid from about 12 ounces of meat. So that's like a great source of not only magnesium, but also potassium.
I love that because I easily am putting 4 to 6 ounces, a huge handful of spinach into a morning smoothie for myself and my boys, and also eat an animal-rich diet. So I love that that is a total takeaway for people listening if they're drinking a Fab Four smoothie or even just sauteing that down, delicious side. Okay, great. So we're adding our greens, we're getting magnesium, potassium, and bicarbonate from spinach. We are checking in our vitamin D levels. What other hacks do you have for increasing our immunity?
Sauna or increasing core body temperature. So essentially especially exercising in the heat is going to raise heat shock proteins, which have antiviral effects. It was like sometime back in March, I was trying to figure out how this worked because the WHO came out in, I think, 2003, looking at SARS, that 133 degrees Fahrenheit rapidly killed SARS. Now, you can't really heat your body up to 133 degrees. So I was like, well, how would this work potentially if we could raise our own core body temperature through sauna? I started looking at the data. And if you essentially inject a cold-blooded animal or a warm-blooded animal with a lethal pathogen and you heat shock them, let's say you throw them in a sauna either prior to or afterwards, like pretty quickly afterwards, the mortality rate significantly is lowered and they clear the virus much better. And so then I started looking at the mechanistic studies, and how this works is you release something called heat shock protein 70 when you raise your core body temperature. Typically, you have to get your core body temperature to 100.4 degrees Fahrenheit or higher, and then you start releasing heat shock proteins. Well, in order for viruses to sort of replicate, they have something called this viral ribonucleoprotein complex. And essentially, there's something called M1 protein that has to dock onto the complex to allow it to be exported out. Heat shock protein 70 is smart and it'll dock onto it, prevent M1 from binding and prevent the viral export. So when I found the mechanism of action, I was like, oh, this is cool, because all the animal data was showing that if you heat shock them before you infect them with the lethal virus, they live longer. And then when you can sort of break it down into the exact mechanism of how it works, that's sort of like the eureka moment where it was like, oh, this is really cool.
That's amazing. You're whether you're working out hard and getting hot or getting in the sauna, you're creating basically the block of the release of that virus out of the cell or?
Yeah, you're creating the block for the virus to export its nucleoproteins, its RNA, so it can replicate. And you're right, your shields are up for about 48 hours after a sauna session. So your baseline heat shock protein levels are up by about 50%. So essentially just doing it, you know, every 48 hours can sort of keep your heat shock protein shields up.
I love that. Everyone needs to be getting hot every 48 hours. So does that work for other viruses as well?
So essentially any RNA virus, let's say, so most common colds are rhinoviruses, and then you have, right, coronaviruses as well that cause some common colds, but also the SARS-CoV-2 and SARS.
Yeah.
And then influenza as well is an RNA virus. So any RNA virus seems to be inhibited by this type of, we don't know for sure, because typically they were giving lethal influenza, so avian bird flu, to these animals. But there was a human clinical study that actually looked at the common cold. And what they did, it was a group of 50 patients, they split them in half. And essentially, I believe it was a 6-month study. And one group got multiple sessions of sauna per week, the other did not. And in the deeper parts of the cold and flu season, the sauna sessions reduced the incidence of the common cold significantly by 50%. So we do have human clinicals too that show that it seems to be beneficial against the common cold. And the animal studies show that it seems to be beneficial against lethal influenza. I suspect that the same benefits would happen with coronaviruses too.
I love it. I have a sauna and I'm going to start using it when I feel myself getting a little bit sick. What would be the ideal amount of time I know we're supposed to get in every 48 hours to reap the benefits, but do we need to be in the sauna for 45 minutes to create those heat shock proteins?
It's going to be different for everybody because some people, they'll raise their core body temperature quicker than others. But typically for, let's say, an infrared sauna, which is set at a lower temperature because it heats you a little bit differently than it can sort of like your typical Finnish sauna, which uses convection heat. Infrared is heating you also from the inside out. So you don't need as hot of a temperature. What typically I do is I do a 20-minute session at about 150 to 160 Fahrenheit in an infrared. If you're in like a Finnish traditional sauna, you probably want to be somewhere between 180 to 200 degrees Fahrenheit for about that same time, or 20 to 25 minutes seems optimal, 3 to 5 times per week. And then there are contraindications to sauna. So if you're pregnant, if you have an active fever, you should not go into the sauna. Those are technically contraindications. Or if you've like acutely experienced a heart attack. But I will say that a lot of people who have had cardiovascular disease that are controlled, like heart failure patients, there's a lot of clinical studies showing that they could potentially have benefits in regards to the arterial health, blood pressure lowering, reducing sympathetic activation and increasing parasympathetic activation. So there's a whole world of studies in the sauna space.
I love it. I'm so excited. And I think that was like the best gift I ever bought for myself. I'm like, I might not have nightstands, but I have a sauna. So let's talk about some more of your hacks from Immunity Fix. You talk a little bit about intermittent fasting. How should people be using fasting?
So I think it depends I'm more of a person who likes to exercise and fuel. So I like to build muscle and then fuel my workouts with food. And so there's like sort of like these two different types of people. Some people like don't want to exercise, and just prefer to really just eat like one meal a day. And there's other people who want to be active, who want to build muscle and then don't really want to fast. And that's sort of my approach. Because essentially, if you're exercising, you basically just wiped out a meal anyway. So you're intermittent fasting anyway. So why would you need to skip an extra meal if you're already exercising?
I love that. So how do you fuel your workouts most often?
Typically with salt and minerals, at least an hour prior, typically to boost blood volume, and that's going to reduce core body temperature and significantly improve performance. Actually increasing peak alkalosis prior to training or prior to any type of event is going to dramatically improve your performance, which is essentially getting the serum bicarbonate level above 30, because you have this massive acidosis that occurs when you're doing anaerobic workouts. And if you can suppress that with things like bicarbonate or citrates prior. So I sort of fuel my workouts with salt, fluids, and alkalinity. And then afterwards, it's always good to consume between 25 to 40 grams of some type of protein and some type of carbohydrate. Typically, you want to consume carbs within 30 minutes, usually about 1.2 grams per kilogram of body
weight. I love it. So let's talk about this pre-workout sort of cocktail that you've concocted. What exactly goes in it to increase your mineral load and, I guess, create an alkaline body?
Sure. So it depends how hard you're going to be working out, how long you're going to be working out, and how much you're going to be sweating. So if you're going to do like a moderate workout, I typically stick with maybe 1,000 milligrams of sodium and 10 ounces of fluid. And I'll slowly consume that maybe 45 minutes prior over the course of maybe 20 to 30 minutes and then stop. And then I have like 15 minutes for it to really absorb into the body. I'm going to be doing a really intense workout, or let's say is prior to some type of intense prolonged event. Usually the maximum or optimal intake of sodium is between 2,000 and 3,000 milligrams, matched with 20 to 30 ounces fluid. And that has to be slowly consumed. And you start usually an hour and 45 minutes to an hour and a half prior to the event. And you slowly consume that over an hour. You can add things like glycine, 2 to 4 grams of glycine to help the sodium be absorbed better. And then you can also, besides that, you can completely replace the salt with sodium citrate if you want to boost alkalinity better. So the studies have used salt as the solution, sodium chloride. But if you replace all of that salt with sodium citrate, and you can also add things like potassium citrate as well, then you're also going to get the benefits of the alkalinity. But even if you didn't do that, that salt solution has been shown to increase the time to fatigue by 21 minutes, which is about 10 times longer than any other supplement has ever been shown. So beta, things like beta-alanine, things like beetroot, they only increase your time to fatigue by 1 to 2 minutes. Salt solutions allow you to exercise for like 21 minutes longer.
Wow. For those people who get fatigued early and want to quit, salt is their solution, it sounds like.
Yeah, it is. And how this works is really interesting, because when you start exercising, you have blood flowing now to working muscle. And so you have this drop in blood volume in regards to where the arteries are in your heart and things like that. And so if you can boost blood volume before exercising, then you're going to prevent the decrease in blood volume that happens due to the fluid shifts. Not only that, when you boost blood volume, you have more fluid that cools off all the organs. So the studies show that you're 3/4 of a degree Fahrenheit cooler when you ingest this type of salt solution prior to exercise. Your heart rate's down by about 10 beats per minute as well. So it's by boosting that blood volume is really actually how you cool yourself off better too.
Gosh, I love it. That seems like such an easy fix for getting a harder, longer workout, having more blood volume. Mm-hmm. I mean, just your heart isn't working as hard, your organs aren't getting as hot. I mean, that's right. So simple. Can you compare what you're talking about to something like an electrolyte mix with glucose or sugar or Gatorade? Because I think there are a lot of electrolyte mixes on the market and many of them contain a form of sugar. Can you talk about the differences?
Sure. Glucose does help with the absorption of sodium. So that's typically why they have given glucose in these solutions. Mm-hmm. But typically they give way too much. So usually you see these Gatorades and Powerades with like 20 grams of glucose or sugar per serving per 8 ounces. And it's just way too much. And you probably don't even need that if you just throw glycine in there, because glycine is going to do essentially what glucose can do without really having any type of harmful effects on the microbiota or your insulin sensitivity. So the difference though is that these Powerades, Gatorades, I think are like 1/10 the salinity that you need. So in order to boost blood volume, you typically need to have a salt solution that is equivalent to the salinity of your blood, which is 3,200 milligrams of sodium per liter. So most Gatorades and Powerades are like 1/10 that. So it's just not even nearly close to enough salt.
And so many people are absolutely afraid of salt. One of my favorite products is Element. Are you familiar with that mm-hmm. electrolyte mix yet? And it's 1,000 milligrams of sodium. And that's a question I get in DM all the time. Like, this is way too much salt. This is going to give me a heart attack. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about best practices for preventing a heart attack and for increasing cardiovascular health?
So I think like best practices when it comes to like salt intake and people being worried about, am I getting too much? If you up and get your potassium, magnesium good, you fix your insulin resistance, there's just a tiny subset that are going to potentially be over retaining salt. Whereas like 99% of people, if you fix their insulin resistance and their mineral deficiencies, they're going to be able to handle normal amounts of salt just fine. So you do have to fix those underlying issues first before you just start consuming more salt. But once you fix those issues, then you can use salt as a tool to fuel your performance or to eat healthier foods that are bitter. And now you can start adding salt to your food and really enjoying your food.
I love it. So how does insulin resistance play a role in having a salt issue?
At least early on, maybe midway through insulin resistance, the elevation in the insulin level causes the kidneys to over-retain the salt. So typically, a healthy kidney, you can consume 100 grams of salt and it won't even elevate blood pressure because your kidneys can just get, they can dump salt so well. And the reason they can do that is because they are filtering your blood and they filter a full teaspoon of salt every 5 minutes. And then they have to actively reabsorb all of that salt, which is a tremendous amount of energy. So essentially we are like these salt filtering machines. So insulin resistance though, then prevents the kidneys from being able to handle any extra salt that they can just typically just dump. And so now you're over retaining the salt. And so when you drop the carbs and drop the insulin levels, then your kidneys can start spilling out any salt it doesn't need.
When someone starts a low carbohydrate diet, can you connect the dots for someone as why they might lose a lot of weight right in the beginning?
Right. Well, so there's a few things that are going on there. One is obviously you are starting to burn fat better. Two, you are starting to lose more sodium and water. So one molecule of glycogen will hold 3 molecules of water. So you do lose water weight in the liver too and in the muscle. And then you're also dumping more sodium just in general because you're no longer over retaining the salt. And so it's, you typically lose an extra 1 gram of sodium. Some people lose 2 grams per day for the first week, and then it drops to maybe 500 milligrams for the second week. And then you're essentially, the kidneys then sort of readjust and you're not losing too much. But a lot of people do struggle chronically on a keto diet from low salt because A, they're eating healthy foods that are now lower in salt. So they have to consciously salt their food. And if they forget, then they can get in trouble pretty quickly. And the second thing is remember glucose helps with sodium absorption. And so you're technically not absorbing salt as well as you would if you were consuming carbohydrates.
So the takeaway here is if you're on a low carbohydrate diet or a ketogenic diet or a whole food diet where we're not getting as much sodium in our food, we need to be a little more conscious about salting our food, and then we'll probably enjoy it a little bit more.
Exactly.
I love it. So outside of eating a whole food diet, getting outside in the sun to convert some vitamin D, getting in our sauna to get those heat shock proteins, what other practical tips do you have for listeners for increasing their immunity?
That's a good question. So I guess we can talk a little bit about diet and how I structure my diet. So I do eat probably about 1 to 1.5 pounds of pastured meat per day. And some of that comes from liver and heart. So typically I buy them in blends, 75% muscle meat, 25% split up between liver and muscle. It's because a lot of people hate the taste of organs. And I'll tell you, if you get them as a blend and you either make it as like taco meat and add spices to it, or you just cook it as a burger patty, you really won't taste the liver. So really important to get those minerals like copper, folate, vitamin A. I'm not talking about beta carotene, the actual vitamin A. And so if you're just eating a muscle meat diet, and you're not adding in organs, it's very likely you're going to be deficient in things like copper, folate, vitamin A. So in addition to that, I try to eat about at least 2 pastured eggs per day for selenium, iodine, the carotenoids, lutein, and zeaxanthin, which are highly bioavailable in pastured eggs. Choline too is important as well. But to be honest, I'm probably hitting my optimal amount of choline just from all the meat and liver that I'm getting. But pastured eggs are a great source for those other nutrients. And then off of that, I typically try to add in some type of bicarbonate forming substance, like the dark green spinach for also lutein and zeaxanthin. Spinach is really a good source of bioavailable magnesium, potassium, and folate, but it is not a good source of iron. And I think there's another one. So essentially, spinach is great for some nutrients. It's very high in iron, but its bioavailability for iron is only 2%, whereas red meat is 20%. So if you're looking to get iron, as long as you're getting about 12 ounces of meat per day, you're going to essentially hit most, if you're a male, most of your RDA for iron. But if you're a female, you probably have to go a little bit higher than 12 ounces of red meat.
And why would we have to go higher as a female?
So the RDA for women is 18 milligrams of iron. So in it for a man is only 8. And that obviously has to do with menses and things like that, blood loss.
Got it.
So I really don't even, I think there's a lot of women who are deficient in iron. And not only that, they can't even move their iron around in their body well because they're deficient in copper, because they work very synergistically. So I really struggle to see how, I think a lot of women are probably anemic, have iron deficiency anemia due to both iron and copper deficiency.
So let's talk about your blends. Are you asking for a blend of ground meat at your butcher specifically? Or do you have an online program that you use?
Yeah, I just go online. So there's multiple companies that will sell those blends. White Oaks Pasture will, Force of Nature, North Star Bison. So you can just find these companies and they typically have those type of blends.
I love it. I'm going to add that to the show notes because I know there's probably a lot of women and moms, like something that I'm really concerned about having a toddler. I know how important iron is for cognitive development, how important choline is for cognitive development, and Sebastian, he's allergic to egg whites at this point, and we're going to start to try and reintroduce that. But I get a lot of his choline through, the kid
he pounds ground beef. And so just getting that liver blended in, I had always done it from US Wellness Meats. I got their liverwurst and like a slice of that and kind of just mushed it into the taco meat, try and hide it from my boys. But I love these blend ideas. That's great. Can you talk about the mechanism of action? You talked about copper, folate, and vitamin A. Can we talk about why those are important for immunity and overall vitality?
So vitamin A and vitamin D help control the balance between your T helper one and T helper two cells. And a lot of people have that off balance and that can lead to autoimmune issues. So vitamin A is also important for the structures, the barriers to prevent viruses. So for your skin, your mucous membranes, your epithelial cells. So vitamin A and D are really important for that. Copper is important for immunity from the sense of it forms your superoxide dismutase enzymes. So copper's zinc superoxide dismutase is something that helps us handle superoxide anions. And you have this inflammatory cytokine storm in the lungs. And so if you don't have good antioxidant status, that can potentially be an issue. And a lot of our minerals actually make up our antioxidants. And selenium is another example as well. And then folate and any of the B vitamins too, they seem to help boost your own function of your immune cells, like T cells and stuff like that.
I love it. So a big fan of pasture-raised meats plus liver, pasture-raised eggs for all of that goodness that comes in what I call the multivitamin of the egg yolk. Lots of dark leafy greens. It's getting us more folate. It's getting us magnesium, potassium, alkalinity. What are some other foods that that we would find in your kitchen?
For vitamin C, I like to do some strawberries and camu camu powder. So camu camu is like technically this berry. That's the second highest source of vitamin C, second to the Kakadu plum. And I get it as like a whole fruit, like fruit powder. And I just put it into lava yogurt to increase my vitamin C intake. It's very difficult to get vitamin C in the diet if you're not eating certain foods. So I like to get it through a whole food powder. And then I do like blueberries as well for alkalinity, for the polyphenols. So I try to get that in as well. I'm trying to think what else. I do take a bunch of supplements like SelenoXL, which is selenium from yeast. I do take a B complex from quinoa sprouts. Typically, most of my supplements are like a whole food source of vitamins and minerals, which tend to be a little bit better than your typical synthetic.
I love it. And are you testing your nutrients every couple months or how do you check in with where you're at?
I have done some urinary tests, the sort of commercial ones. I don't know how accurate they really are though. So short of like going to a doctor and getting some of those tests, which I haven't done due to the whole pandemic and things like that. So I haven't really tested myself, but I probably should be doing some more tests for sure.
Yeah. Nutrival is one of my favorites. I can get you all your minerals and vitamins and amino acids and fatty acids and all that stuff. Awesome. Well, it seems like you have a really healthy lifestyle when it comes to moving our body. You alluded to it with the sauna information earlier in today's podcast, but are there anything outside of food that we should be doing other than working out and working out or increasing the heat of our body, eating a healthful diet, looking at our nutrient status? Any last final takeaways for our listeners when it comes to protecting their body against this pandemic, against flu season, against all that we're up against?
Grounding fresh air in sunlight. So getting even light, you don't even have to bathe in the sun. Just getting light into the eyes in the morning helps set the circadian rhythms. And then if you can get outside a couple times a day too, and just get light into your eyes, is very good for setting your whole biological clock. And circadian rhythms are important for immune function as well. And sleep. If you don't sleep well, it's going to crush your immune system. So turning off the lights at night too, like all my neighbors make fun of us because our house is like dark by like 5 o'clock at night and everyone else's home is like lit up like a Christmas tree. But like, that's not how it's supposed to be. Like, the sun goes down and it's supposed to be dark. Then that helps set our melatonin and all these other things. So if you don't sleep well, your immune system is going to crash. And actually just like a few hours lack of sleep can induce insulin resistance fairly quickly as well. So avoiding that light at night, getting fresh air too. So not just getting outside to get light into the eyes, but fresh air is higher in ozone, more oxygen, actually has antiviral effects too. And then grounding as well. Grounding is great. There's a ton of clinical studies on grounding. A lot of people think it's voodoo, but there's at least 20 human clinicals that it can reduce stress, lower blood pressure. So it seems that, you know, through the skin, through these millions of years that we evolved on Earth and not being on concrete, but actually being connected with the Earth, that our skin can pick up these electrons, which help us neutralize free radicals and things like that. So I think people who go to the beach and put their feet in the sand, they can feel the difference.
Oh, I definitely can feel a difference. SoCal native. And give me even just like a half hour at the beach with my feet in the sand, and I'm a totally different person.
Sure.
So what would you say, just so people listening, if they don't know what grounding is, that's skin contact with the earth, can be dirt, grass, sand. How long should someone try to get out in nature with the earth or ground?
I guess as most as they possibly can, because we used to always just be totally immersed in nature. And now we're just peeled back away from it. And so we're like in these like isolated little, you know, these houses and stuff and apartment complexes, and we're not even touching the earth anymore. So as much as you can, really.
I love it. That's a great takeaway for anyone listening, especially moms. Take your shoes off with your kids, get in the backyard, get on the grass, get in the sand, get dirty. Well, Dr. James, thank you so much for being here. Where can people follow along? Where can they buy your books? Give us all the deets.
Sure. So my Instagram and Twitter is at Dr. James Dinick, D-I-N-I-C. My website is drjamesdinick.com, and my books are on Amazon.
I love it. We'll link to everything in the show notes. Today was such a jam-packed episode full of takeaways. I know there's probably a lot of people out there now really interested in the sauna. So for our last little tip, what is your favorite sauna and what should people be looking for in a sauna?
So I actually have a Clear Light sauna. They offer a lifetime warranty. They're low EMF. So I love them. And so they provide the infrared sauna, but some people like traditional. So it just kind of depends on what you like.
Yeah. I feel like the Clear Light, when it comes to infrared, it heats up a little faster with those, with the ceramic, right? There's some ceramic pieces.
Yeah. There's like these infrared pads that sort of go all the way across, and they have two heating pads on the front too. So you're getting like the exogenous heat, but then it's also heating you up from the inside out. So they go up to 158 degrees Fahrenheit.
Love it. All right, guys, get out there, get hot, and support your immunity. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for listening to Be Well by Kelly. Please subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Learn more at bewellbykelly.com and follow me on Instagram at bewellbykelly. I would love if you picked up my books, Body Love and Body Love Every Day. They're sold on Amazon and at all major booksellers.